I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Box Set Pod. I always feel like I have to say it like that because that's how Howell does it.
But, yeah.
I mean, you've guessed it, listeners. That's right. Howell is not in charge again this week. And even better, we've gone one step further. So it's me, Matthew Wandless, Jamie. Howell. Sweet silence.
Sweet silence.
The man is in, where is he? He's in Berlin, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in Germany, I think. I think he's had a tattoo, you know. It might have been a transfer.
Whoa. What?
I mean, there was some footage on WhatsApp. I didn't really watch it. I think it might have just been a some kind of, you know, sort of fadeaway tattoo thing. I don't think it was real because Howell's too prudish.
All right, given that he's not here, let's take a moment to discuss the enigma that is Howell Evans. Because, just to give you a little bit of background, I've never met Jamie.
No. Nope.
And I've only met Howell once, very briefly. The reason I'm on this podcast is because of a mutual acquaintance, Ben Hilton, who's a filmmaker and a director and a producer. I mean, all those things come under the umbrella of filmmaker, but, you know, there you go. Do you know Ben personally, or do you only know him through Howell?
Yeah, I know him from college days. Well, around college time, yeah.
Halcyon days.
The good times.
Yeah, Ben used to live with Hannah and me for a little while when we were living in Fulham. And I've been in one or two films of Ben's, I think.
Is Hannah your wife?
Hannah is my wife, yes, that's right.
Right.
Sorry.
Okay.
Ben asked me on to do a podcast ages ago when we started talking about The Walking Dead, actually. I think it was on the first episode I ever did. But then Howell came down to London one day, and him, Tiernan, who also is guest on the podcast, and Ben all came and had lunch at the Pizza East underneath my office. The first thing that happened when I met Howell was he shoved a dictaphone in my face.
Oh.
It was like recording. It was like he was going to record our entire lunch. And I don't know how to describe Howell. He's like he's a meaty little fellow. So, like, he's short but sort of like powerfully built, like a large dwarf, if you imagine that. And he's got a kind of long, oblongy face with ruddy red cheeks and just kind of mad eyes, sharp, mad horse's eyes, you know? Like anything can happen. And
oh, yeah.
So there are two things I know about him. One, he's clinically insane. And the other is he travels more than most people I know.
Yeah.
Yet, the only sources of income that I know about are his rabbit nursery, which I believe is now defunct because of something uncontrollable that happened, some kind of natural disaster. And he does a radio show.
I think his rabbit thing, the rabbit hotel's still going.
It is still going? I thought something bad happened with that.
I think it did, but I think they rolled with it and it came through the other side. I don't know, though. I've not been in a while, but yeah. I think he still houses rabbits. He's got that. He does a bit of radio, commercial radio.
Oh, and of course, we found out last time that he's a bloody teacher as well.
And yeah, he has students that he fills with his weird thoughts.
Someone saw fit to give this man power over other people's approach to the radio world.
I know.
It's uh It's a phenomenon. But how do you think he manages to travel so much? Because I know he had a radio thing about traveling cheaply.
Yeah, he is. Him and his brother, Johnny, his twin brother, are actually really, really good at finding good. They are. It's something that they're very, very good at, and they love doing it. They love finding new deals. So if you were to say, oh, I want to go here, would you be able to find me the best? They'd find you a better deal than you would find for yourself. I can guarantee that. They are very good at it, and they love doing it. And that's all they do. They just love traveling. Like, his wife, Sarah, she loves traveling. She's got, you know, a good job, so I think they've got a good bit of money stashed.
Yeah.
And they can just, you know, travel the earth like littlest hobo. And but they tend to go to, like, Vegas. They're obsessed with Vegas.
They do. They go there all the time.
Not just Vegas, but casinos in general. They like to go to casinos in this country quite a lot.
I don't understand that at all, because casinos in this country are quite a dreary affair.
Yeah, well, we did go to one a few weeks ago. I went with his brother Johnny, and, you know, Johnny loves playing. I don't really enjoy I don't enjoy gambling. I just lose money anyway. And it is it's a bit dingy in there as well. It's not exactly
It's not the MGM Grand, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, hats off to him. I would love to travel more, but that's quite a good niche skill to have, like a really shit but kind of still useful superpower to be able to find good travel deals.
Yeah.
I would quite like that, like a Marvel superhero called Thomas Cook.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Anyway, we've given already too much time to that beast. That horrible beast.
But I love that. What did you call him? Meaty. I like the way you called him meaty.
He is very meaty.
That was such a good choice of words for him.
Because he's definitely
not,
you know, he's not fat. But
no, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, he's like a, it's like if you, if you shrunk an ox into, into Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
And it was like, but it didn't quite fit. So you ended up, it's like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's a weird looking chap, and I don't like it's a weird thing to do the first time you meet someone, to just shove a recording device in their face.
Yeah,
well, unless you're a journalist, I guess. But anyway, he did forward me an email that we received from Lee.
Okay.
So thank you, Lee, for writing. And Lee says he loved the Game of Thrones analysis. He was refusing to watch it, but then I think we actually kind of lured him in. I think he's sort of going down my route, really. He does say that it's tier 3 television, so I'm afraid you're not gonna really enjoy his company that much, Jamie, being the super fan that you are.
Else does he say?
He said I mentioned the ending of The Sopranos, and he wondered if they could have got away with panning from a battle between the Unsullied and the North post Daenerys' killing. And it's like, so the conflict just continues.
Oh, man, that would have been even worse. I don't think you can do that with a show like Sopranos.
Yeah. Because they did kind of wrap everything up before they finished it as well. And it was just that thing of like, this isn't going to stop, but we have to stop telling you about it. Yeah.
It's funny, like, the whole Game of Thrones, now the dust has sort of kind of settled now, it does feel like the general consensus is they did a shit job of ending it. Like, that's the narrative that's a narrative that's kind of unfolding in the month that's passed since it ended. And I think that's probably how it's going to feel overall. Like, I know a few people who've said that they would never watch it again because of the ending now. Like, a lot of people... Yeah, no. I would still watch it again. I still love it, but I do agree that they screwed the pooch on that one.
I'd say it's in the kind of echelon where if there was an episode, if I was I'd just come home from a night out and it was about 11:30 and I was flicking channels and I saw, there's an episode of Game of Thrones. I might watch it for about half an hour. but I could certainly never watch it from start to finish again. But that's nothing to do with the way it ended. That's just me. But anyway, look, I'm just going to go. Lee actually has some interesting points that he makes here.
Okay.
He said, the ending was broadly right, but so rushed. I like the dragon use being analogous with nuclear war. Analogous with nuclear war. The absolute power corrupting absolutely. And Kantian philosophy and democracy. King's Landing being ruined was quite emotive. Danny potentially being a tyrant was spelt out. It's just the depth that was missing.
Yes, very well said, Lee. That was it. And the depth comes from not taking shortcuts in developing characters, which they took in those final two. I think in the final two series, it took a few shortcuts, but certainly in the final few episodes, it did.
Yeah, it did. But let's not go over that.
No, we didn't, yeah.
Although, have you heard the evil brand theory that's going around as well?
No.
Which is that basically from the moment that Bran became the three-eyed raven, he's known exactly what was going to happen and has deliberately let things occur so that he ended up where he did end up on the Iron Throne. Well, not the Iron Throne. Whatever new throne they make. I mean, that'd be a good job, wouldn't it? Getting the, you know, being the new throne maker.
Yeah, it's a good gig, isn't Gendry. It? Yeah, I mean, Gendry would love that shit, wouldn't he? I mean,
He'd do a lovely job, I tell you that.
Yeah, and he'd make a comfier one, because it never looked comfy that chair.
No.
Never looked, you know.
No, not ergonomic in the slightest.
No way.
Yeah. But well, anyway, so what have you been looking at in the month since Game of Thrones passed?
Right, well, we've tried to, I mean, the big things and the big shows that have like followed Game of Thrones, first of all, is Chernobyl. That's gone. That's been massive. That's been talked about a great deal. I know loads of people recommending it to me. And I know that the advertisement campaign is going big on the whole. This is the biggest show on IMDb, rated 9.7 out of 10.
Yeah.
Which is impressive, but it's still early days and it's only a 6-episode miniseries. So I'm always reluctant, like, if something's short, you know, it's got less room to make a mistake, you know, as well. But I do, from what I'm hearing, the detail's incredible. The guy who's created it researched it for 10 years to make sure he got it accurate.
10 years.
It's the first episode I've watched. It is incredibly gruesome at times, but it's fascinating, frightening, and compelling. And yeah, it's really gripping from the very start. It doesn't let go. I thought it would bother me that it's all English voices playing, you know, trying to pretend to be Russian. They're not even doing a Russian accent. They're just doing whatever accent they decided. And it doesn't bother me at all, actually.
No, I prefer that decision when it's made like that. What I don't like is people in different accents talking in English.
Yeah. No, it works well. And it's a really good cast. And I believe it gets better and better. And I hear that this one actually nails the ending, which should be interesting. But that's
when it's written for you, isn't it? You know, it's one of those ones. Like a couple of people in my office have been talking about it, and I'm meaning to get to it, but I keep forgetting that it exists. And I think maybe that's to do with the fact that it's on Sky rather than some of the ones that are more easily accessible. I have to turn on my PlayStation and turn on the app.
It is heavy going as well. Like it's a heavy watch. I'm trying to get my wife to watch it with me. It's very hard because like she likes it, but she's like, oh, I have to get in the mood for harrowing television, and that's not easy. But what you know, when you do it, it's worth it. It's just you know, getting your mind ready for that.
Well, as you know, Jamie, I am a fan of the heavy. And we will actually, I should say later, we will be discussing the Handmaid's Tale, which returned to our screens on Sunday. And we're actually going to have a little bit of a guest. She's a friend of mine. Her name is Idil Sukan. She's a fantastic photographer and now also a director of photography and is moving into kind of film. And she says, I think she's currently working on a TV show at the moment as a, I don't know what the title is, someone who takes photographs behind sets, you know.
All right.
Yeah, she's doing, I don't know, photography. Photo taker, chief camera person, not filming camera person. I think that's
a great time. Job.
Yeah.
Wow. But, I'd love that job.
She'll join us shortly, and we'll take a brief break, and then we'll introduce her. So yeah, we'll be talking about Handmaid's Tale. What else have I been watching? Oh, I watched another absolute bastard of a show. Have you seen any of The Virtues?
Oh, I've been meaning to watch that as well. That's a short one, isn't it? The Shane Meadows show, isn't it?
Yeah, Shane Meadows. What's his name? Stephen Graham. Yeah. You know, it's pretty bleak stuff. It's a guy. Yes, the show sort of opens with this guy whose son. He's divorced from his mum, and their family are moving to Australia from Liverpool.
Mm.
And he's kind of devastated by this and ends up back at his where he came from in Ireland. And you start to learn about his past and his family, and none of it is good. None of it is good.
And yeah, I haven't watched it, but it looks harrowing.
It is. And I don't know exactly what's happened to him, but you have a pretty strong idea fairly early on. And I don't really know why I'm watching it, because it's just like lifting up earth. Like scraping away earth with your hands, and it's like there's just little bits of glass in the dirt. And when you scrape it all away, there's just a nest of spiders or something really horrible is down there. Actually, no, it's not spiders, because that's frightening. Something like a dead squirrel.
Oh,
yeah. That's what you find. It's just. I mean, I'm now worried that I'm comparing something awful in someone's childhood with a
dead squirrel.
Yeah. So but it's very good though. It's very good.
Yeah. And he does that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does do that. But I don't know. A friend of mine really tore it to pieces, and he tore Shane Meadows in general to pieces. And he's,
what?
I mean. It's just that it's all the same shtick, isn't it? The manner in which he did it, I was actually like, well, maybe you're right. I don't really know what I'm gaining from this. And, it's just kind of misery porn.
I think it's interesting because I've not watched it, but I read an article with Shane Meadows talking about, in the promotion of this, he's talking about how he'd recently been through a process of therapy. Because he's throughout his life, he's had a number of issues with depression, I think, and he wanted to sort of look into it. And then he went to a therapist, and he talked. So he's had quite a tough childhood, which comes through in a lot of the stuff he's done. You can tell that a lot of it comes from that kind of that theme. And in his childhood, basically, the rough idea is, you know, he had to move to live with his uncle during his childhood because his dad was accused of murder, and his dad was wrongly accused of murder. And then while he was living away from home, he got abused by some people. But he only realized this after seeing it. I think he went through a process of this process of, for people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, it's almost like hypnosis. It's like they do this thing that allows the brain to access memories that you've been suppressed that are really traumatic. He went through this process, and he said that it completely brought up memories he'd totally forgotten about. And I think that's kind of where The Virtues has come from.
Well, it does. Now that you say those things, it does have a very kind of autobiographical quality to it. I won't go too much more into it, but, oh yeah, that's given it a whole new layer of loveliness there.
Yeah.
Well, enjoy. Idil's about to come and join us now, so we will stop for just a brief moment and get her on.
Okay.
Okay, welcome back. And joining us now is Idil Sukan. Hello, Idil.
Hey, everybody. Hello.
Hey.
It's me.
You know, I did think somewhat ironically when Jamie, before we were starting the show, he said, how do you pronounce her name? Because he'd only seen it in text. And I said, like little, without the L.
Oh,
and I know that you are a big fan of that particular joke.
Yeah. It's, I mean, Little, obviously, famously, is where I was conceived.
Yes.
Yes. Which is not the first time I've said that joke.
No, and I know that.
I had to say that joke. Great setup, Matt. I've had to say that joke maybe 120 times. Just to make them feel bad. That they laughed at my name, that actually has like emotional resonance for my parents.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's a real thing. Yeah, no, I really was named after the shop. No, it's a beautiful word that that means a beautiful place. So, which I guess some people may think a little is, depending on what your needs are. So who knows anymore?
Yeah. Anyway. I'm going to digress off this already slight digression. Tin and Duyeb, who you know, Idle, and has been a guest on this show in the past, are going to steal some of his material right here, because he has received post to Timran Dovyeb, Tarnan Dweeb, but my personal favourite,
oh man,
Timothy Daniels.
Oh, so they demand he have a normal name.
Yeah.
Which is just they're just like, no, I don't want it. I don't want it. You're just Timothy Daniel. Those
I am
names
not
that
even
going to
try.
Yeah. They just translated it into language they understand.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's incredible.
You know, Wanderlust is a mildly unusual surname, but people generally, it's pretty phonetically spelt, so people are fine with it. So, and Jamie Atherton, you've had no problems, have you?
Jamie Atherton.
It does what it says on the tin, doesn't it? You know, it's,
yeah. You've never known the hardship.
You don't know what it's like.
Yeah. We were actually, Edel, we were discussing what your job is that you've just come from. What is that person called who takes photos on the set?
A photographer, Matt.
Yeah, I know. All right.
Someone who has a camera and takes photos.
Do you not get a thing like a gaffer or a grip?
Like a proper photo. So I do look at the current. So I'm working on two shows, both of which I've signed NDAs for, so I can't discuss them. But I can say, I know it's so exciting. I mean, it literally could be like just the shittest show about what do we do with dead leaves? But it sounds exciting. As soon as you sign an NDA, I mean, it's thrilling. But I am doing two different jobs. On one of the shows, I'm an art department photographer, so I'm and the other job I'm a unit stills photographer. So unit stills is just, you know, you take photos as they go, you just take photos of the action, you know. It's a thoroughly demeaning, the most demeaning job on set, because you're in everybody's way, you want to be where the camera is. But of course, the camera is there, the main film camera.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know. There's some tremendous on-set photography out there.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, of course, you're trying to sort of find a different angle. You're trying to find a complementary angle before the first AD, you know, like yells at you for being in everybody's way, and you hold production up, costing them millions of, again, I should probably shouldn't be saying this, all contributing to the NDAs. But you're kind of in everybody's way trying to take photos. Nobody knows who you are apart from production, who are somewhere else at the time. So there's no one on your side. There's no time available for you. So that's one job, great job. And then the second job is art department stills. Again, no time. You're in everybody's way, but the slightly more exciting thing about that is that the photos that you take are in universe. So if someone, there's a murder, and the murder in the story, not on the podcast, but there's a photo
could
of
happen.
Yep, there's three of us. They could, there's like a murder in the story, and then it's on the front page of a newspaper, and someone has to take the photo of the dead body or the photo of the deceased to run in the front page of the newspaper. There's a portrait on the desk, or there's a portrait of the long lost love in someone's locket as they look wistfully upon the horizon. And someone, has to take that photo. And that someone is me. Yeah.
So can you, are you allowed to talk about what stuff have you worked on before the stuff you're working on now that you can't talk about? Is there anything you can mention?
Yeah, I worked on Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams. That was very exciting. That was very fun. And then the building a kind of again, you know, your standard dystopia, building some fun photos and drawings and illustrations for that. I worked on this Agatha Christie written by Julian Fellowes, called Crooked House.
And who did you photograph and paint for that?
I photographed lots of people.
Glenn
Close. I'm trying to sort of remember. Yeah, Glenn Close, which is absolutely terrifying.
Christina Hendricks.
Oh,
I remember.
An absolute. Yeah, I mean, you have it burned in your memory. You have the photographs burned in your memory. You keep it in your locket while you look out onto the horizon. And then, of course, Christina Hendricks she's gorgeous. You know how people are like, oh, is she gorgeous? When someone's so beautiful on TV, you're like, but maybe she's, different in real life. But she is an absolute, like, angel on earth. And then, of course, everyone's sex dream, Gillian Anderson. That was incredible. She, again, maybe that contributes to the NDA to confirm that she's everyone's sex dream, but she's phenomenally stunning. And
I think that's been pretty widely disclosed. That's
you know what? Yeah,
domain.
Everybody's figured it out. It's leaked.
Yeah.
That was very fun. And of course, very recently, Johnny English 3, where I took photos of all the spies who had been spoilers, all murdered. That was also very fun. Actually, an incredible amount of fun to do. Yeah, and various others. Those are my kind of jobs at the moment.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
not bad.
Pretty good.
Not bad.
That makes me excited to know what you're working on now, because those are good projects. Even Johnny English 3 is blowing my brain there. So I really want to know what you're working on now.
Well, you
secrets.
Can continue to not tell us often.
Yeah.
And you watch a lot of TV, right?
I do. Yeah, I really do.
Yeah.
Probably too much.
And to further set you up, actually, as a person, I have previously on my old podcast referred to it all as my feminist spirit guide.
Oh, that's how you referred to me.
I appear
in the night.
Well,
I'm
appear
furious,
on my
furious.
Text messages after I say to you, Idil, how should I feel about this? I'm confused.
Well, you should feel wrong about all your feelings is basically
right.
Like how I respond. I mean, basically my role is to take something that means a lot to you, that you really love and hold dear in your heart, and ruin it for you.
Yeah.
Just piss all over it with feminist piss. Femi piss. That's kind of what I've realized my calling is.
Yeah. You are good at it. You are good at it.
Ruining things.
Yeah, it's really skilled.
Yeah. Matt can't, he finds it difficult to love anything anymore.
Yeah.
He's scared of his own feelings.
That does come across, actually. Matt? You know, is this what has happened?
That's true, actually. My status on this podcast is very much the I am the Statler and Waldorf of the box set pod. Yeah, I wanted to bring you on this week, A, because we don't have Howell, and I thought, why not bring in someone much better?
Oh, yeah.
But B, like, well, it's quite a week for female-centric TV. We had Killing Eve started on Saturday and Handmaid's Tale on Sunday and then Big Little Lies on Monday.
That is quite a week.
It is. And
it turns out you haven't watched any of them.
None, not at all. I don't. You know what? I don't like women on television.
No.
Bloated. They need to lie down and rest with like hot water bottles.
Yeah.
I worry about them. Ultimately, I worry about them.
Yeah.
It's horrendous being on set when bloated. Anyway, subscribe to my podcast where I just discuss when I'm bloated or when I'm not bloated. I watched Big Little Lies, the first season.
Oh, you
and
did?
I'm really,
I didn't realize.
The first season. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I watched it with a man, which I believe is not correct. It's not what Reese Witherspoon wanted.
No.
It was ex-boyfriend of mine. And so I'm quite excited to watch season two, you know, manless, the way it was intended. As is on the credits, when the title, pre-title sequence just informs you.
Do not watch
with men.
Yeah.
So I'm really like thrilled and excited.
I can't wait to watch that one, but I also, there is part of me that's just like, I don't know why we have this.
Yeah, that's true. It was such a perfect self. Did you watch it, Jamie? You watched
this
one? Yeah.
I really liked it.
Beautifully
conceived.
I mean, obviously we're talking from not having seen what they do with, I mean, you know, Meryl Streep texted. You're not gonna say no.
Yeah.
You'll write all night. You'll stay up all night writing a part for her if she's texted you.
Yeah. I mean, I know it was based on a book, wasn't it? And the book was just that the story that they covered, I believe, or I don't think they did miss anything out.
I was
going to
ask
if
the source material had further volumes or anything like that. But
it's possible. I don't think so, though.
I think it was just a self-contained book.
I think there's nothing wrong with just, you know, having just a show that begins and ends. And it's just this wonderful little time capsule of brilliant TV. And yet, you know, very few shows do it. One of the few shows that I've seen do it and did it well was out on Amazon. I don't know if you've watched it, Homecoming, with Julia Roberts
as a
therapist. That's kind of a weird... That was based on a podcast, I think. That was a drama series that was then made into a television series. And it's one of the best endings to a show I've seen, because it doesn't set anything up, doesn't leave you. It just perfectly finishes off the journeys these characters go on, and it doesn't suggest that there's going to be any more coming. And I'm happy. I'm more than happy for it to end there, and it's still brilliant.
I don't remember you guys giving it a massively positive write-up on here.
No, I don't know if Howell watched it. I can't remember, but it wasn't great. It's not a great show, but I thought it was a really nicely put together and nicely made show. It's still worth watching. Like, Julia Roberts is great and the rest of the cast are fantastic, and it's a really interesting story. So it's worth a look. It's on Amazon Prime and it's interesting, definitely. But it's not something that I'd like shout from the rooftops, like a Handmaid's Tale, maybe. But it's still worth a look.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm really looking forward to series two of Big Little Lies. I thought the first one was fantastic.
Yeah, it was kind of completely wonderful. And everyone was like so terrifyingly good in it. I think sometimes you forget, you know, just how much of a difference. Like, I mean, it sounds like completely extraordinary, but like, to how much of a difference good acting can completely transform, like, yeah, a viewing experience. Because there's so much craft going on, obviously, and I think, but it was just kind of slightly transcendental, like how good Nicole Kidman was, especially, I suppose.
I'm not traditionally a fan of her either. Like, I don't think I've really enjoyed her in much stuff.
Yeah, I get. Well, I think she's just made a lot of very difficult, challenging decisions. You know, like, I think she's like tried to really, you know, make quite complicated films that are not necessarily that easy to watch, and like actually probably push herself as an actor and as a cross person.
I think that's when I enjoy her more. Dogville is probably the other thing I really like.
Yeah.
But no, nothing else. She has made, yeah. Mind.
But yeah, she really kind of, yeah, hits it right out of the park in Big Little Lies. It's
stunning. Reese Witherspoon as well. I've always liked Reese Witherspoon, but I thought in that, like, wow, it could easily have been quite an irritating character. But she's brilliant in it, and she's really endearing, and also just this force of nature in the whole show. And also, what they did well was like the twist is really well done. Like, it could have been a bit of a like gimmicky twist, but that moment, that great ending where there's that realization, it was really cleverly done, and really
and
like
the way
a nice
thrown in all those kind of half glances at her on the beach and all that stuff. But then the final moment where they face to face, and you're like, oh shit.
Yeah,
it was
brilliant.
It's like incredibly difficult to play like a character who's meant to be kind of irritating, like her character, like people don't necessarily get on with her very well and have to endure her character. And yeah, Reese kind of nails it, and she's still immensely empathetic and endearing to us, the viewers, but still is a sort of difficult character to get on with like the rest of the car, with the rest of the characters. Well, one thing that I was really kind of blown away by is that there is I don't know if boys have this, but with women, I think with sister, you know, me and my sister, and then me and my very, very close female friends, I think there's a really interesting way that we can communicate wordlessly, especially around men who might be terrifying. So men in clubs, or men on the bus, so even with strangers, so other female strangers, you know, there's some sort of amazing telepathy that we're able to enact, that we immediately understand that someone is in danger or something is happening. And it's very, very difficult. Like, I'm struggling to find another instance of how this has been portrayed on TV, like, as perfectly as it was at the end of Big Little Lies season one, where the revelation is wordless. She doesn't have to point. And, you know, it's happened all the time. Like, I saw a girl at a function, and there was this guy like absolutely like cornering her and being very, very weird and very aggressive. And I, you know, just wordlessly went and said, oh, hey, I saw you. I didn't know her at all, but I can't remember what I said. I was like, oh, did I see you earlier? I just really wanted to ask you a question about this. And she's like, oh, hi. Yes, of course. Yeah, we did see each other earlier. Yeah, we sort of yes-anded each other into safety.
It's like the quickening in Highlander.
Yes, that's exactly how it is.
It's just another worldly sense, and you know that someone is near and that you have to react in a certain way. Except you don't chop their head off.
Yeah. I mean, it still produces like a huge amount of like...
thunder
power
and lightning. And,
yeah, thunder. I mean, there's like a lot of storms that take place immediately above us. And then we're safe. Yeah. And all the men are dead. That's Highlander, right? That's the plot of Highlander. Everyone dies. And so it was kind of this amazing moment at the end of season one where, I mean, how horrifying would it have been if, Shailene Woodley, comes out and just, points and be like, oh, gasp. It is he, for he was the one who sullied me. And you know, and the other women are like, he, are you sure? And it's like, well, let's think about it. You know, there's no discussion. There's just trust. And there's also trust. There's no hey, are you sure? Where is your evidence? I think there's this other thing
like, were you wearing a short skirt?
Or... yeah. Did you have your rape whistle on you?
Yeah.
was it really rape? I think, again, this immense, immense, unspoken, the most tender and powerful landing that it could have. So it landed so tenderly into a group of women who 100% trusted and knew her to be telling the absolute truth. There's not a shred of doubt in any of their minds. This is why the finale could happen. This is why the denouement could happen. That's why the killing happened. And because they absolutely knew in their hearts that what she was saying was absolutely true, and she would. And so this amazing, tender, empathetic, sympathetic landing that her admission is it's him. She didn't even have to say it's him. She just needed to look. And then the power that comes from that trust is that, okay, now it's amazing, how powerful and how incredibly, and you see how much support there is. As soon as you trust someone, something can be done about it. And there's only now that something can be done. There's only now. And they acted immediately. And, obviously they act in this, incredibly vengeful, everything burns to the ground way. But I think on the whole, that's pretty
well
just,
justified, especially
pretty well justified. Yeah.
I think my worry is that with season two is, because I imagine, I've not read the book, but I imagine a lot of what you're talking about was also really well delivered in the book. And that helped sort of guide the drama. Yeah. But I worry that, just like Game of Thrones, I struggled with it.
It was so well directed, though. It was so well written.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a lot of, I think, there's something else. I can't remember who's talking about it, but this kind of realization that the first kind of 20 minutes of Wally doesn't have a single line written. It's all action, and yet it's kind of absolutely there's no words, but it's absolute, but it's still scripted, and it's scripted in a really beautiful cinematographical, movie making way. It's not scripted like a novel. It's not scripted like a short story. It's scripted really cinematically. And I think it was the same. There were so many little bits in Big Little Lies, and actually in The Handmaid's Tale, I would add that
that
have cinematic script to them that obviously have been guided by the book, but have been. I think it's very, very tricky. There's a couple of reviews. I haven't seen Good Omens, but there's a couple of reviews from my friends and the people that I trust their opinion of and online that are saying that it's taken. The book, there's been so much, they've taken the book with so much reverence, they've approached it with so much reverence that they haven't necessarily transformatively expressed it cinematically. And I think, so this is kind of what's giving me some hope with Big Little Lies season two, is that there was so much transformative, transformative approach.
When you have a great production crew like that and a great group of actors as well. And obviously HBO are going to throw some money at it because it was so successful the first time around. And, when you have all those things in place, I'm pretty confident that they'll turn out something really special again.
Meryl Streep.
And in fact, same team.
Yeah, that's true.
Did either of you guys catch Sharp Objects?
Yes. Brilliant.
I finished watching that a couple of weeks ago, and my God, that's fucking good.
Oh, yeah. I was too scared to watch that.
It's deeply unsettling.
It's very
worried. I was worried about watching it. And is it too much?
There was a moment that might have actually made me yelp slightly, and I can't think of it. But I am a giant coward, so it's fairly easy to do. It's not tricky. Go and catch it. It's on Now TV now. It's
I
started watching it when it was originally broadcast, but then we missed a couple of episodes and it was gone before we got through it.
But it is excellent. Great.
I'd say it's. I mean, it's very different to Big Little Lies, but I'd definitely put it in the same quality echelon.
I thought. I don't know why, but it did remind me. Yeah, there was something about it that felt very. I don't know. I thought it was the same. The person who wrote the book for Big Little, I thought it must have been the same writer, but it wasn't. It was Gillian Flynn who wrote Gone Girl. Who did it, but. It is, it's really, really powerful. And Amy Adams, again, like, she's one of those actresses that is just can do so much with just her, just the look and just the silence. In the same way with Handmaid's Tale, Elizabeth Moss, who I think for me is like the best actress on TV at the moment, is Elizabeth Moss. I think she's just so. She's so good. I love her in. I love her in Top of the Lake as well.
Yeah, it's really good. She's so good in it. That's also very beautifully directed, actually. Yeah,
and then Mad Men as well. And it's so weird. I mean, I don't think either of you are that big fans, but she was in The West Wing, playing the president's daughter, and I don't know how old she was when she started doing that, but it's I can't think of many TV actors who I've seen from that age through to where we are now. I mean, the West Wing started in 1999, I think. So that's a long fucking time.
She's been around.
And she was brilliant in that. She's brilliant in Mad Men.
Because I always think about, with Mad Men, well, some of my favourite moments in Mad Men are the bits between her and Don Draper. Like, there was something about that relationship that was kind of like really...
Yeah.
They just sort of knew each other, like, without really saying it at times. They kind of had a real intimacy.
Well, it's that thing that Idle was saying about visual scripting. And so much of Mad Men is like that. And if you don't buy into that, then I can imagine that Mad Men would come across as quite a boring, if or even shit show.
I didn't get to the end of it. I watched a huge amount of it, and Elizabeth Moss was excellent. She became like the most valuable player, like quite almost without even really you didn't even really notice that she was becoming so brilliant and important. She really kind of starts to steal the show. Obviously Christina Hendricks is brilliant in that as well.
Of course. But I think a lot of people, it's that thing of you get it in a lot of TV shows where everything has to be spelled out for the audience, and they treat the audience as though they're stupid and can't figure anything out for themselves. And I like it when things are left unsaid, and certainly like Sharp Objects, my God, you don't know what's happening because they don't tell you, and you really have to kind of stay a couple of steps ahead. But we've talked about that stuff for a while. Let's focus on Elizabeth Moss's current project, The Handmaid's Tale. Jamie, you liked it, right? But you would You do like it. Okay, right.
I like
you
had it a lot.
Pacing issues, though, right? Or was that just Howell?
That was mainly Howell. My issue. It's hard. Like, I find it hard to watch as a parent. Like, it's brilliant, it's like there's so many like red flags and like insecurities around being a parent that are really exploited in the show.
Yeah.
That it is at times like harrowing, but it is. I love it. I absolutely love the show. I love the way the season two went with it and her going back into
just
that
say
world.
That I think Idle hasn't quite finished season two, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I have a few episodes to go before I embark on season three. I think I found it. It's absolutely not the kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of shows that I just stream constantly in the background while working or while doing anything or doing housework. But it is absolutely not possible to do this. Because you're distracted for a second and then You're like, what? What's going on? What? Is everyone dead? Are they all going to die? What? Are they all being hung? What the hell?
Yeah.
It's completely horrifying. So I've had to really pace that out quite a lot, which is why I haven't got to the end of season two yet.
No, it's not a pleasant show to watch. But then it's got this lovely kind of... It balances those moments where something nice happens, and there are few and far between, but when they hit, they really hit. And it's like, it's like when you have that little moment where someone does something nice to you when you've had a shit day, and that's the thing that lets emotion out. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, because there's a certain catharsis that they allow every episode. It's not just, you know, wall to wall grim.
Yeah. And even within the world that is so horrible and violent and, you know, oppressive, like that little passage, I think it was middle towards end of series one, where he was kind of developing a relationship with her when she was, yeah, you know, playing Scrabble with Commander Waterford. And it was tainted and it was horrible, but it was release.
I mean, in a way, that is kind of a bit terrifying, because you don't necessarily want to, you know, you don't necessarily want to be reliant on Stockholm syndrome as the only way to have release.
No, God, no, no.
But yeah, I mean, but I think that what that is really interesting about the show is that any kind of system of oppression is built in such a way that allows moments of tenderness and moments of rebellion almost in a structured way to allow people certain releases and a certain idea, or so, basically tricking them into believing they have autonomy, but they have autonomy very much within a very defined paradigm. So, and that actually contains them, because if they're always, if there's a kind of constant beating, then you sort of almost don't get anywhere, but you want almost people to start feeling comfortable in the oppression. And then that's when, you know, that's when your system of oppression is incredibly successful, when people are actually upholding it. And I think that's what, obviously that was very, very important in the book, and but done really well in the show, that it's so harrowing that I talk about this like quite a lot just in real life, not Handmaid's life, but in today, women are very much, and we always have been very much like our own Gestapo. A lot of the times we're the ones who enforce like patriarchal standards on ourselves, and also on like our friends and on women we see in the media, and you know, we like you know, even clicking on like a Daily Mail article should be like completely outrageous, but you know, it to gawp at other women's bodies or like whatever it is that we're doing, we're the ones who uphold those systems of oppression, and even in tiny, tiny ways. And that's why it's very difficult to break out of. And it's kind of, if not, there's a really amazing moment in season two when it's very clear. I think it's Joseph Fiennes, who says it. Yeah, Waterford, who says the wives will never agree. And I think this is really essential, is that all it would take is for every single woman to just say, well, no, that's it. But we don't. And the only moment of release that they have is when they all stop them. They all say they won't stone their friend to death. But even that is such a tiny amount. Yeah, the Handmaids. Yeah. But that even that is such a tiny, tiny little moment of rebellion. Obviously not enough. But it does, you know, all it would take is for all women just right now to, you know, just stop everything, refuse to buy into it, refuse to buy into oppression of of women from all different races, from all different backgrounds, you know. But that's all it would take to just stand up and refuse to be pawns of that oppression. Yeah. But it, you know, we can't. We're all locked in so many different ways that we're even like completely unaware of.
Yeah, and that's the part of the way the show keeps you captivated as well, is that you feel so like this is a world that resembles our own very much. It's not that far removed. It's only a couple of degrees one way. And the fascination with the show is also like, how did they get to this point? How did they get to that? And watching that sort of evolution of like this regime take over,
yeah,
is like really part of like the horror and the fashion, like watching a slow moving car crash or something. It's just like you kind of, you're gritting your teeth and you're tense while you're watching it completely, but you just want to know what happened to the society that took them where they are.
It's one of the great strengths of the show, I think, is those little snippets you see throughout series two,
yeah,
more so of the exact kind of bullet point de-evolution of that society. And then this
signing,
idea of this kind
signing
of,
for the pill.
Yeah, and just, it doesn't take, because of the stuff that you're talking about, Idil, where it only takes so many nutcases with guns to put down an entire city of people.
Yeah.
Because everyone's terrified. And it's like, you know, if everyone goes nuts, if society goes nuts, there aren't enough law enforcement or military people to contain it. It can't happen. But because you don't have to stop everyone at once, you only have to stop a few people before everyone else falls in line, things can work in this kind of horrible way. And seeing those little moments where there were masked men with automatic weapons on streets with crowds in front of them, it takes this what looks like a fantastically terrifying scenario and makes it really even more terrifyingly possible. And I don't think it would take that horrific a breakdown of society for a small sect like Gilead to exist somewhere. And there are, there are places where this kind of stuff has happened.
Well, I think it's happened in our society. I mean, I think that something that's kind of interesting and like obviously a criticism of the show is that in many ways it's co-opted moments of Black suffering. Like, for example, indiscriminate killing at the hands of police with no warning. And, you know, she was reaching for her paper. She was reaching for ID documents is obviously incredibly reminiscent of how a lot of Black men have been, yeah, I mean, shot and killed simply for being Black in America. And it has co-opted that and put that on white women and has created an incredibly hit show where we're now asking, how could this be possible? Like, are we really so close to this kind of society? And it's like, well, actually, there are huge amounts of the population in America who are being treated as secondary citizens, who are being stripped of rights. There are horrific stories going on about how people are being treated on the border with Mexico. There are, you know, also there are horrific story. I mean, we're talking about sort of, it has been suggested that we're in huge violations of human rights in terms of some of the impacts of austerity and disability cuts and all this kind of thing, and people being sort of killed in the process of trying to maneuver through red tape. And it's basically a kind of horrendous, like Kafkaian nightmare that they kind of wake up in where they're too ill to go to work, but not ill enough to get benefits, etc., and they sort of die in the middle of it. So there's, you know, it has co-opted different little experiences of oppression from us. I think our society and has simply grafted them onto the whole population and specifically the white population. And you know, to a white viewer, I think that suddenly it's in our face, and we're like, oh no, now it's important. And I hope that means that we are then we are then kind of retroactively inspecting what is going on currently, and realizing that there are things going on currently that are absolutely unacceptable. And that we're letting go and letting go and letting go, and they're being just, you know, swept under the carpet. But there are people who are living in this kind of absolute mess, absolute terrifying mess of a society, and they are being oppressed in very similar ways. I mean, obviously, you know, when slavery was legal, black women were routinely raped. And made to have children who were then enslaved themselves immediately. They're born in slavery. And I think what's kind of interesting is that there's kind of some revisionist sort of stories about sort of black women, enslaved women falling in love with white masters being empathetic and things like that. And there's that revisionist kind of love stories that have come out, a couple of films, one film in particular last year, and a few other stories that tell this kind of idea. And it's kind of it's horrifying because it's like, well, again, it's this kind of Stockholm, that is love, quote unquote, under duress. It's still rape. It is still a huge abuse of power. You can't put a nice bow on that and call it a beautiful love story. You know, at the very, very most merciful thing you can say about that could be Stockholm syndrome. But who knows? There might be one exception, but why concentrate on the exception when the more important stories are, you know, what really happened, the absolutely violent, violent abuse. And also Indigenous people in America, Native Americans, women were enslaved, children were taken away to boarding schools, children were ripped away from their parents, from their mothers, and taken away and interred separately. So,
you're starting to get a feel for what we were talking about, my relationship with Idil.
I've come with like a jar full of femipis and just doused it onto Matt's face.
No.
Yeah, no. He's learned to not complain.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not going to start comparing, would be a mistake. I think that.
Do you like the show, though? Do you
fan? Like the show? Yes, I love
the show. Oh, yeah. The Handmaid's Tale. Yeah.
What
sure.
show? Yeah, I mean, obviously, we can. There's so much stuff. I mean, Elizabeth Moss is absolutely amazing in it. The man I keep forgetting the name of, Joseph Fiennes, is wonderful. Yvonne Staronsky, who obviously we all know from Chuck.
What are your feelings on Chuck Whitley? Because it's Howell's favourite show.
Oh, Chuck. We were talking about Chuck. Chuck is like just the most indulgent white boy shit you've ever seen. But the thing is that I have watched it, I think, right the way through three times.
Really?
I think easily. I mean, not for a very long time. I think it was one of the first shows that was streaming on Netflix or Prime or something. And I think I had it on in the background, and then I realized what am I doing. But it's very, I mean, it's very stupid, yeah. And very silly, kind of fun, I suppose.
How Yvonne managed to cajole me into watching the whole first series of it, actually. and I just would routinely come in each week and shit all over it.
Yeah, it's not good as such. No. But it was I think it's dated very, very badly. I think a while ago it was kind of pretty good background television. It's kind of nonsense action, high octane television. And Yvonne Strahovski was incredibly beautiful in it and very good. And I'm very, very excited that she's on this, absolutely killing it. Like, yeah. She, you know, she's just showing off that she's much, much more than something like Chuck.
I have never seen such a leap in contrast between two leading roles that someone's
played. Brilliant casting choice. It's so exciting. I think it's such a good casting choice because, you know, it's in Chuck. She plays an impossible replicant woman. Like, she's, you know, she's just this perfect, unattainable babe. She's good at absolutely everything. She has body to die for. She's just stunning.
And changes clothes on camera once every episode.
Does she have like a team of stylists outside, like following spy stylists?
I can't believe they have it's just one of those things that blows your mind, where her job is working.
Oh, her job, and she wears the most outrageous costume.
Yeah, she's like a milkmaid.
She's a milkmaid wearing this sex milkmaid outfit that you buy in Anne Summers. Like, yeah. She's not like a normal milkmaid.
She's a milkmaid in sex lederhosen.
Yeah. She's ready for banging, milkmaid. So again, it's great casting choice. Yeah. But I think in Handmaid's Tale, she's playing the perfect wife, this kind of pious, you know, she's playing a vision of perfection. Mm. And I think that's interest. She's playing an unattainable woman, and for her to find that distance, she has this like majesty about her. She's like, she's very, very detached, and she plays into that. But of course, she gets to show the hollowness of that, and she gets to show all the cracks of that. There is no such thing as unattainability. There's no such thing as putting women on pedestals, which is the whole point of Gilead, is that they put women on these like pedestals that they determine what the scope of that pedestal is. You know, it's a very cunning, I think this language, you know, I think I get really annoyed with this language with like men, when they're like, oh, you know, I like when men say like they adore women, or like a woman can never like do anything wrong. I think there's this story from like my granddad that he didn't think women like grew hair like on their legs, and he once like he was with a lady friend. Should I tell this story about my granddad? It's too late.
I'm not sure.
he found like a hair, like a stubbly hair on her leg while they were making out, and he was apparently so horrified that he ran away. He ran away from the date. And they didn't get married, and he married someone else, I suppose. My grandmother, who was hairless,
had discovered Veet by this point.
Yeah,
but I really like, and I think you're on the cusp of it, Idle, the evolution of her character in this. And I don't know if you've seen the trailers for season 3 or anything. I don't want to give too much away, but
no,
she's clearly going
to
play like a big part in what looks like, I've only seen obviously there's only been one episode of series 3 so far, but it looks like it's a more hopeful beginning to this closing sections of this narrative. And I'm very excited that Bradley Whitford's in it because of The West Wing.
This is an amazing story about Bradley Whitford, a little tiny story where he didn't realize that a few of the lines in Get Out were a joke, where I think he says in Get Out, he says, hey, I'm a nice guy. I voted for Obama twice. And he didn't realize that was taking the piss out of white people who try and look cool and not racist and liberal and what have you, by like showing off how many times they voted for Obama. He just thought it was a normal thing to say. Which I really enjoy.
Are you trying to slag off Bradley Whitford?
Yeah, a little bit. That's going very badly.
Wow.
But I just want to point out that I love Bradley Whitford, and also he's amazing in Get Out, and Get Out is phenomenal. So it's just like the most delightful little story about him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm very excited. He's in season 3. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've been avoiding all trailers because I'm very excited about it.
I'm really kind of, you know, Hannah and I were both in tears by the end of the recap from series 2. Because it's, as you say, Jamie, as parents, it's just like it's reaching into your very worst fears, really.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but it does feel like we might be coming out of the darkness. Do you know, Jamie, if this is the last series that?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like it is, but I don't know. But I mean, it's interesting because I remember we got a few episodes into season 2, and I almost gave up on that. I thought this is too. There's a bit in season 2 where, I don't know, give too much away, but things go back to being shitter again, basically. And there was a moment where I thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't have her going back into that horrible world. Yeah. And I'm glad I stuck with it because it was rewarding, but it was a show that I almost gave up on as well, even though I was really enjoying it. It's just too hard at times. And I'm hopeful that there will be some more hope and the uprising will come about in this third season.
This is a bit of a tangent, but if you saw season 1 of Lost in Space on Netflix, there was a similar kind of feeling that I had where they thought of this amazing idea and then they did the amazing idea and then everything went badly and it was terrible and it failed. And then they thought of an amazing idea and then they did that idea and everything failed. And I think this happened like 5 times.
Yeah.
And like by the end of it, I was like, I don't understand. I don't understand what we're watching here. Like, this is horrific. They're just going to die.
I haven't seen this. It's this people trying to get off a planet kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to find their way home.
Yeah. And it's kind of like quite delightfully made, but you know, after a few, like, oh, are they just terrible? They're just terrible at this. they're just very bad at getting off this planet. And so I want to watch a different family who are better, who have better hiking skills and better survival skills. I'll watch that show. I don't want to watch a show with people who are incompetent. So I sort of know what you mean. Like if it's, you know, you try really hard and then it fails, and then that is just life. And I'm specifically watching TV to forget about the series of failures.
Yeah. I think you've gotten to the point that Jamie's talking about. What specifically were you referring to, Jamie?
Oh, I was referring to when she escaped, because she escapes, doesn't she, in season 2. You got to that bit, yeah?
Yeah,
of course.
And she gets caught again. You've got
caught,
to that
bit.
And I've got the plane. That's right. She's on the goddamn plane.
Yeah. She's about. And at that moment, I almost thought, all right, I'm done. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, that was really tough. Really tough.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult.
Glad I did.
Oh, that was brutal, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was hard.
And you've just been through the bit where they're in the colonies, haven't you?
Yeah, oh my god, the colonies as well.
Did you realise it was Marissa Tomei in that episode?
Yeah, so I had to point this out to Matt.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone realises that it's Marissa Tomei. I didn't realise for a very long time, and then at the end I was like, wait! And I looked it up because I wasn't sure. It's Marissa Tomei being brilliant. as again another unattainable woman. I mean, Marissa Tomei is obviously incredibly beautiful, and you know, and she plays this kind of odd character. God, it's such a affecting episode. This, she, you know, she says that she was. I can't really remember, but obviously Alex Bledel's character, you know, lies to her and says that that a wife was kind to her once, but of course wives routinely oversee constant monthly rape, and they're complacent in it. They are part of the suppression. They are themselves suppressed, but they are also complacent in such a horrific act. So it's very difficult to know where to put your anger. Is it on the system, or is it on the people who are part of that, so who are suppressed but complacent? And so she takes it out on Marissa Tomei's wife character, and she murders her. And it's horrifying. It's horrifying because it's so complex. It's so difficult. Like, who are you really mad at? Just a young boy who gets caught up, you know, with his school chums, and he ends up being part of Nazi youth, and he then joins the army. Are you really mad at that guy? Yes. Yes, absolutely. But also more mad at the system in which that was allowed to happen. Yeah. So it's really complicated. And I think they tread that. So I like the fact that they're not, I think The Soprano, I mean, I know Matt, I don't know about you, Jamie, but I know Matt is a huge, huge fan of The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And I think they do that in Sopranos as well, where there's no easy outs or easy endings or easy, like, and the moral of, like, the very, very bad Frasier episodes where they're like, well, we've all learned this terrible lesson. And I think that never, ever happened. We're never allowed that out. We're never allowed that catharsis. We have other catharses, maybe, as Matt was saying earlier, but we don't get that. It's not easy. Things aren't easy in oppressive regimes. They're never.
Yeah. You know. Well, what I thought.
That's like, I wonder.
Yeah.
Like,
things
aren't easy in oppressive regimes.
You know
regimes.
What? It's not easy.
Well, what I thought I would just get annoyed with her being back in the oppressive world, but it actually got juicier. Like, it was like, it's like someone's made a chili in a slow cooker, and the longer you leave it, the tastier and the more flavoursome it gets. And, like, that's what happens with The Handmaid's Tale, is those interchanges and exchanges between her and the main characters who she's stuck with are even more, they've marinated for so long in these juices that they're even more, like, captivating, and, like, just the death stares they give each other and become even more compelling. So it actually surprised me that I enjoyed it more in the second series because of that. So it can work both ways. If it's done well, and they've done it really well, then it's just juicier and tastier.
Yes.
Which is a weird thing to say, but yeah. I've had giant chili yesterday.
I had chili yesterday.
I want to talk about chili. I'm going to talk about chili. It was really good. I left it marinating for a while.
Also, I mean, we've
chili.
Got to the
chili
point.
Is not easy in an oppressive regime.
No.
We've got to the point in the podcast where Jamie's hunger is now.
Evident
in from all sides, and eventually he'll just start saying the word chili. So I think we'll wrap it up there. We've gone quite long anyway, but Idil, thank you so much for coming on this week and making much more sense than Howell ever has.
It's a real pleasure to be helicoptered in for that.
Yeah, I would like to get you back one day. And Jamie, go and have your chili.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go and watch the last episode of the, what the hell is it called? The Stephen Graham thing.
Oh, The Virtues.
The Virtues. I'm going to go and watch that. And then
amazing.
Just, bleed myself gently into a bathtub. It'll be good.
Great.
It'll be a lovely evening.
Evening.
Indeed. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please, as always, get in touch at studio@theboxsetpod.com. I think I've got that right. Or on the Twitters. What's your Twitter?
Oh, it's at idilsukan, which is IDILSUKAN.
So for your hourly dose of femipiss.
Yeah, just if you have a show that you really love.
If you want to have something deconstructed to the point that you hate it.
Come and say hi.
Hey, if you like the Lego movie and you want to have it torn to pieces.
Oh my god.
At idilsukan.
Please. There you go. That's one keep for another baiting time. Me.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you. And goodbye.
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 Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.